did you have a nice Valentine's Day?
Yeah, it was really nothing happened. This is married life for you guys.
The most romantic thing I've done this week around Valentine's Day is start watching the new True Detective season.
Whoa, that is romantic. Take notes.
Are you watching it?
No.
Oh my God.
Is it good?
It's so creepy. Yes.
Okay.
So far, so good. I'm only like halfway through the second episode right now, and but it's all done now. They're all done. So.
Oh, so you can binge it.
If anybody wants to see scary, creepy gore.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, there's time and place.
There is a time and place. And it takes place in Alaska, like at the tip of the Arctic Circle, where they have basically this period of time for almost 2 weeks where it's like the sun doesn't rise. It's just dark.
Oh.
So, you know, a lot of people kind of going a little nutty.
Yeah. Yeah.
As would I.
That makes sense. Yeah. If I didn't see the sun for a while.
Yeah. So far I'm in and I'm like, who chooses to live here? Why do people live here?
That's a really good question.
There's so many other places to
if
live
you're in,
with a daily sunrise.
I'd like the north, let us know.
Do you think Liz Hill has an answer to this?
Maybe. She's from Alaska.
Yeah, should ask her.
Alaskaites.
Alaskans?
You have to. Alaska. I like Alaskaites better.
I do too.
Okay.
I do too, for the record.
Welcome to the Musician Centric Podcast. We are two freelance violists living and laughing our way through conversations that explore what it means to be a professional musician in today's world. I'm Steph.
And I'm Liz. And we're so glad you've joined us. Let's dive in.
I'm watching this completely different thing called Platonic.
Ooh. Oh, yes. That's
on
right.
Apple
you were telling
Plus.
Me about this.
Oh, my God. It's so funny. Like Seth Rogen and Rose. What's her name?
Burn. From, like,
yes.
Their neighbor's days.
Oh, I don't remember that movie.
Yeah, they were a married couple in it. And they were...
Okay. They are really funny together. They are... This show is really funny. I highly recommend. It's not for children. But...
And SFC.
It's really good. Yes. Not suitable for children.
What's the premise?
So they were best friends back in college, and they've since parted ways, and she became a mom. She has 3 kids. She's married to this lawyer guy. She's like, you know, very suburbia. And he became a brewmaster and opened up a brew pub. And so he's like kind of, not failure to launch, but like a man child.
That's also so millennial.
Yes. So the premise is that they're now 40 years old.
Uh-huh.
They come back together and they're fast friends again.
Oh.
And they're going through life, like helping each other through these moments. And it's hilarious.
I will definitely
they're just
check
really
out.
Funny.
I will definitely. That is like the antidote to True Detective.
Oh, my God. Yes. It makes my husband and I laugh out loud. Like very loudly.
I love it. So we talked with Drew. We had Drew back.
Drew has been back, and we were really thinking about this really seriously, like who can we bring back from our earlier seasons that has new stuff going on? And I will tell you this about Drew. He always has new stuff going
yes.
on. This guy is always pivoting. He's always shifting. He's got his finger on the pulse of the music industry, and he's always inventing a new path. So he was a natural choice.
Yeah. I mean, he's so thoughtful, and I think it's part says the things that need to be said, but it's also just kind of like drawing conclusions from outside places that he can relate to our industry and just makes a lot of sense. Like he just makes a lot of sense with these things he's discovered. And I think struck or excited about the fact that we had this conversation the last time he was on about money, like essentially about the value of money and that when you create things, you basically create new value and new value brings money. And it just blew my mind. And it was this seed that then I kind of have been just growing with ever since that conversation. It really stuck with me. And he was blogging back then, and he had written a really eloquent blog about that whole concept. And then here we are 2 years later, a little over 2 years later, and he's got this, he's taking it next level, basically, right? He's just like taking that concept and saying, we need to use this to our advantage, this concept that like everybody has something new and creative because everybody's voice is different. And how can you specialize yourself in a way that you can be there for everybody? In other words, the extra classical musician, which again, he blogged so brilliantly about.
Yep. He's got great pointers for musicians that are up and coming and that are taken straight from the business world. So what skills do you need now as a musician in order to carve your own path? And so he talks about those. He talks about his extra classical musician idea, like you mentioned. So I think you're really going to dig this. So let us know what you think.
Yeah.
And enjoy part one of this conversation with Drew Ford.
Located in a historic mansion in Tacoma Park, Maryland, you might get the impression that the team at Potter Violins are as formal as the breathtaking building that they work in. But when you go inside, instead you'll find the most relatable, skilled, and friendly staff.
Yes, the people at Potter's are what really make it a special place. I love visiting because I know that whoever I work with is not going to make me feel like I'm crazy or just being picky. They're kind of like your favorite bartender. They're great listeners who give you what you need without judgment.
Yes, their technicians are not only super talented, creative, and resourceful, they take the time to collaborate with you so that the process of getting your instrument at its best really feels like a partnership.
So if you're in the area, definitely stop by and introduce yourself to Chris, Rob, Kimberly, Derek, Jim, Melissa, and the whole team, or visit potterviolins.com to find what you need online.
It's so fitting then that their shop is in this beautiful old house because the staff at Potter's really makes it feel like home.
Drew Alexander Ford, known online as That Viola Kid, has a reputation not only as an accomplished performer, but also as one of classical music's most recognizable personalities. Drew was called the future of our field by Sphinx Organization President Afa Dworkin, and as the creator of hip-hop string quartet Whole Soul, Drew aims to expand the limits of string playing. Highly sought after in popular music, Drew has shared the stage with A-list stars like Adele, Alicia Keys, and Earth, Wind, and Fire, among many others. Recording viola for the Beatles' final song, Now and Then, is the crowning achievement of Drew's budding recording career. When he's not on the concert stage or in the recording studio, Drew shares his entrepreneurial experiences with students from institutions like Harvard, MIT, Cleveland Institute, the Juilliard School, and he's served as a consultant and presenter for a range of organizations from local not-for-profits to Fortune 500 companies. And in addition to all this, he has the distinction of being the very first repeat guest on our podcast. So add that.
Is that your crowning achievement?
Let's go. The top. That's the top. Yeah.
Oh, you're the sweetest.
Change it now. I'm going to tell my publicist.
Welcome back.
I'm telling my publicist.
Welcome back. We're so thrilled.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Steph.
So what inspired us asking you back, other than that you're just an awesome, amazing guest, is that we saw your Substack article on the future of classical music. And the hot takes abound. The most provocative being that there's no money in classical music. So I loved that headline. Yep. I mean, I thought that was totally clickable, totally relatable to what we're all going through right now. And I wondered if you could just tell us about how you came to write this article and what it means to you.
It's something that, you know, I felt when I was back at Juilliard. I would be called to go to a studio and I'm like, yeah, I'm a Juilliard grad student. You know, it's not like there are a bunch of them lying around, you know, maybe in a marketplace that would afford me a livable wage. But that really was not the case, especially when it came to playing classical music. And I just didn't really understand. I was like, I thought in order to make a living, I just had to be good at my instrument. But while I was at Juilliard, I started listening to other podcasts and started getting information from other sources. Like Planet Money and Freakonomics Radio and How Stuff Works. Yeah. And I started just listening to a lot of podcasts and learning about economics, learning about the world in general, and trying to understand where does classical music fit in, like, the machine of the global economy? How does it fit? And I got to tell you, it's really tiny.
Yeah. If you haven't seen this chart, go on Drew's Instagram or join his Substack. And there's a chart on there about the little piece of the pie that classical music earns digitally.
Mm-hmm. It's a Nielsen report. Nielsen does a lot of market research. And they were tackling in this 2019 report, they were tackling music and the gross revenue from sales of digital, physical sales and streaming of music by genre. And classical music was dead last at like
less than 1%.
1%.
Yeah. In many categories.
Less than 1% in many categories. Yeah. So if we are fighting, and I think I saw somewhere this was weeks ago, so my number's a little fuzzy, but we're talking maybe low nine figures worth of, like, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars total, like, revenue generated in the whole world for classical music. And so there are a lot more than, like, a million, maybe not a lot more, but there's probably like a million classical musicians who are trying to get jobs at any one time across
worldwide. Sure.
Right. So do we all earn $100? Is that really the market cap? Is that what we're all worth? $100? You know, all of the years that we've put together. So I was like, okay, why is nobody talking about that? Why are we still encouraging students to go get student debt to then enter a market where they're not even equipped to extract any value or collect any value for their hard work so they can eat? You know, that's just, the math wasn't mathing for me. So I had to write about it.
Yeah. It's something that Liz and I have been talking about. I mean, we're freelancers in the Washington, D.C. area, and we're busy. Like, we're playing with orchestras, we're teaching, we're doing recording when we can, playing all different genres of music, playing string quartet jobs, you know, playing pop string quartet jobs too. But if we're at the kind of the top of our field here in the D.C. area, and we're not making those, we're not making really a living
wage. I've had this crazy thing circulating in my brain since December, which sort of was the impetus for this conversation, where I had been busting my butt from September to December, and I was all over the place, and I'd overworked myself and overscheduled myself, which is a recurring theme in my life that I, you know, always yeah. working on. However, I think I hit a breaking point because I was so burnt out, and I was playing a job in December that I typically like to play, but I was frustrated over, you know, certain like logistical things that were happening that happen every year and they still haven't been fixed. And I'm in my head like, why hasn't anybody figured this out yet? You know, like, I've figured it out. How has no one else figured it out? And I was sitting there and I'm like, am I going to do this job for the rest of my life? Like, this is it. As far as like being a freelance classical musician in DC goes, we're at the peak pretty much. And what I've been really interested in too, which is related to this article, and this conversation keeps coming up in various ways, is that, okay, so we've like escalated ourselves to this peak, you know, in demand for a freelancer in the DC area.
Sought after.
We're super sought after. It doesn't translate to more money. It doesn't mean you're going to make a better living. It just means you have a reputation of being able to perform at a certain level. And so that like works within your community, but it still doesn't translate to more dollars. In fact, in some ways, when you're considered in demand, then there are certain opportunities that won't be offered to you because they assume you're not available, right? So there's like that whole thing, which is so fascinating. I don't really worry about that, but it's so funny because I was just literally scrolling through Instagram before we got on, and I saw this little orchestra had like one of its first performances here. It's like a startup orchestra. And it was all these like young kids who are probably just out of school, like University of Maryland and our various universities around here. And the way they were describing the organization, I was like, oh, this is familiar, because I was part of these groups when I was in my early 20s too. And we're all just trying to do the same thing. And it's like not increasing our value, which it's huge. Like, it's such a crazy thing. Such a crazy thing. Anyway, yeah, lots of thoughts about that.
I think it's unfortunate. I think it's a multi-pronged issue. I think many people don't understand our work. And they think, well, yeah, that's a really nice hobby. Yeah. That's like super cool. I mean, you joined orchestra, you know, at 12 years old, 10 years old, and you know, you just stuck with it. I really wish I'd stuck with it, but you know what? Yeah. I'm glad you're doing it.
Good for you.
Here's $20. It's like, oh, good for you, man. Oh, will you babysit my kid, please, for $50 an hour and teach him the intricacies of bow technique? So it is a marketing problem on our behalf, because we often, you know, it always comes back to unionizing. Like, unfortunately, we have so many people who are desperate to make any money, desperate for any visibility, desperate for any, you know, notoriety, because that's what matters more to them, or matters more to you when you leave school. You're just like, I just want to be seen doing the thing. Because like, I had everybody tell me that it was a joke.
I'm going to start up an orchestra with my friends, and we're all going to make $50 for the weekend, but it's our passion and everyone will see us doing it. Yes.
Yep. But the economics is a true case of us going into this field not understanding business, not understanding negotiation, not understanding value exchange, leverage, not understanding our real function in society, which is marketing. Music is not, it's a product, kind of, but we make other things sexy. We give soul to ideas. So because we don't understand our true power and our true impact, we don't really negotiate in many cases in the classical music sphere. We don't negotiate to our own benefit. But if you go outside of classical music, when you're talking about the broader music industry, you've got sync licensing, you've got distribution deals, you've got the ability to put your stuff, you know, on albums. You can write, you can compose, you can collect royalties for certain recordings with certain contracts, but you have to negotiate those contracts. You have to see that if my music's going to be played for 1 million people, do I really need to take this buyout or is a rev share?
Yeah, these are just things that most of us have no idea what this world is. So how did you start learning about it? How did you start realizing your worth and what the value of marketing?
Well, I stopped listening to classical musicians.
Who were giving you advice.
It's like, why?
Yeah.
Who are giving me advice on what to do? I just started like looking to people who seem to be making a lot more money.
Right.
In music,
right.
And they're not classical musicians. They're producers, they're writers, they're songwriters. And so when you understand those economic models, like it makes a lot more sense. Like labels, you know, they put up a lot of the production value. They put up a lot of marketing and distribution. They use their relationships to get your art in front of eyeballs, but then they take a cut of everything depending on the deal, right? Where we're all out here playing the game of earned income. We're not thinking about ownership. We're not thinking about earning residual income because we have equity in a certain venture. So I think just understanding those business principles, ownership over, you know, wages, it's a huge multiplier in leverage. And I think that people will have a different experience of this economy if they really kind of understand that. But that being said, we also have to take into account that like we are also fighting a commodity game. Like just playing a stringed instrument, it's not enough leverage to really ask for more money if you don't have a brand associated with it. Because if they just need a violinist or if they just need a cellist and then you're too expensive, they're just going to go ask somebody who's going
right.
to play it for much less. So we collectively have to understand like, look, if I'm taking this gig for $50 and pizza, that means they think they're gonna think that's what we're all worth moving forward. So we have to have a conversation amongst ourselves too.
Yes, that's a quote in the article. Gone are the days of the anonymous antisocial string player. And hear. I'm like all about that. I'm like, yes, like every single person that we share a stage with has their own voice. Like they have something in them that makes them separate from the other person sitting on stage with them. And we just are not encouraged to think that way when we're trained in the orchestral world. And, you know, there's a lot of us doing the work. Like I would say there's a lot of us doing the work to try to get to this point, but it's still the minority of the group of us, the demographic of classical string players out there. But it's funny because I was telling Stephanie, I was excited to talk with you about this because the last time we talked, you were the first person that I really understood the concept of money being a thing that can be created when something has value. My mantra for this entire year is that my energy is actually my most valuable currency, that like just because I'm going to get paid $1,000 to do this job doesn't mean it's the right direction for me to go. It's because if it's taking away my ability to express myself or to do something that's authentic with my own energy, then it's probably actually going to drain more than just my bank account. I had to play around with this a little bit. And it's a scary concept for a lot of people to wrap their heads around, but it is 100% true. Last year, I was offered a gig that I used to do that did not pay me enough. And I had left because it didn't pay enough. And when I got asked to come back, I said, sure, but here's what I'm going to need. And they said, okay.
I love that.
Okay, sounds good. That's great. We'll pay you that much. What do we got to do to keep you?
And you are no longer a commodity because you knew your value, you asked for, and they were like, okay, we're going to meet you there.
Thanks. But it takes practice.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Entrepreneurial skills. Most people don't feel they have the agency to speak like that when they get a job offer, right? So
it's a longer game too. It's not like the day-to-day, am I going to be able to pay my bills? You know, am I maintaining my reputation in this by saying yes? But it's the long game of what is my brand, like you said, Drew? What do I want to be seen as, known as? What do people perceive when they hear my name?
And I get asked by kids, like, when do you know when to ask for more money? And I'm like, I tell them you'll know. But like, honestly, it's when you feel like that, Liz. It's like, I don't want to do that. I really don't want to do that. You're going to have to pay me this. Otherwise, I'd rather stay in my bunny slippers.
I love that so much.
Eat some ice cream, you know?
Like that's a litmus test.
That's when you know, when you've had enough. And like, you don't feel like that when you leave school. You'll do anything. You're just so excited to be there. But then when it's Groundhog Day and you're like, man, I'm working really hard. I'm tired and my bank account is still empty. And you want me to show up anyway?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And I wonder, like, how has this thread progressed over generations? Like, everybody who's been in this field or in this career field before us has gotten to that point where they're like, yeah, I'm not going to do this anymore. This is a crap job and I'm not going to do it. But how are we approaching it in a way that's different? And I think that's the question, because that then helps shape what the next generation of musician will expect for themselves getting out of school, right? Right.
Yeah, we need to relay the mission. I had this conversation at the Grammys 2020 with a woodwind player friend of mine, and she was telling me a similar thing. She was like, "Yo, I gotta go teach like 4 students after this." I was like, "Are you serious?" She's like, "Yeah, I'm killing myself. I know it's January, but yeah." She's like, "I gotta teach couple students for like $40." I was like, "Look, high schoolers need gigs too." And she and her brain exploded. She was like, "Whoa." I never thought about it like that. It's true. If you're taking every gig that comes your way, you're also taking it from people who are probably going to appreciate it more, who the money is going to totally be worth it for. And you're giving up the opportunity cost of spending your time doing something else that could possibly be more highly leveraged so you can get on that path of retirement and financial freedom. So,
and I love that too, because it creates the opportunity for other things to come and fill it. But it's hard to let go of, you know, like creating space in your schedule, creating space in your mind. It allows these other opportunities and the opportunity to be creative yourself. You can't do that if you're running here and there and everywhere. You can't have ideas like, you know, Substacks in your blog post. I don't even know how you do it, because I know for a fact that you are busy and you are all over the place. So where does all this like creativeness, where do you make space for that?
I think it was Duke Ellington. He got asked a similar question. He said, I get most creative with the deadline.
Yeah.
And for me, I used to make weekly and for a time daily YouTube videos. And that was at a time where I was not working. Okay. This was right after Juilliard. I was not getting, the only money that was coming into my bank account was teaching a 4-year-old who couldn't speak English yet and playing in subways for like 4 or 5 hours, $60. Uh-huh. That's like food for a couple of days. You know what I mean? So I'm treading water and desperate to make anything happen so that I like didn't regret. You know, going into such crazy debt. So during that time, I was like, I got to do something. Now I'm very busy providing value for clients, recording, performing, not as much teaching. So I was like, man, I can't even cultivate this brand that I've built. I can't keep creating content. What is the smallest thing that I could do that would have the most power? And I'd been doing research for years because social media algorithms were really starting to piss me off. I'm spending hours to like make a piece of Instagram content and it shows it to 3% of my audience. And I thought it was a good piece of content, but it's not exactly what the audience wants to see at that moment. The audience's tastes are always changing and therefore the algorithm's always changing. So that is stuff I can't control. And so I realized, oh, this is good. It's good to have a big following and have a brand, but I don't own this audience. How can I have a better, closer, more direct relationship with my audience? And I learned about creating an email newsletter. And just the multiplicative power of having an email newsletter. And so I was like, well, maybe I can write a 3 to 5 minute piece of content every week, release it on Friday, and try to provide value, update people on what I'm doing for now. So I can start, you know, maybe having more control over the audience so I can let you know when I'm doing shows. Yeah. I can let you know when I do drop a YouTube video. And it's not algorithmically, I'm not reliant on the algorithm. It's people that want to see it. Because that's what following is supposed to be about, seeing what you want to see from people that you want to see it from. So that's why I started Grace Notes and started back in October last year. It's February. I'm on a 5-week streak. It's going to be week 6 when I drop drop on Friday, and I'm really excited to keep it going.
Well, this makes me think of, so these are skills that you have cultivated over your career. You read a lot. You also write a lot. So these are skills that like a multifaceted musician needs to have. And I didn't mention this in your bio, but there's another self-coined term that you call yourself, like an extra classical musician, right? Yes. And when did you, how did you realize that that was something that needed distinguishing?
I think that there have been other words to describe the type of work that I do before. A lot of people refer to it as crossover. You know, people who are like, they might have played classical music or they may not have, but they just do other genres. But it always comes with a pejorative. It's like, wow, they couldn't cut it in classical. They couldn't really make it happen. I'm like, who can?
Who's making it happen?
We've already established this. Who's making it happen on, I literally was looking through this is a sidebar, the AFM, the American Federation of Musicians. I got the newsletter, like the magazine today. I was looking at the different auditions. There's an audition for section viola for the Louisiana Orchestra. $25,000.
Week.
For a 36 week. I'm so sorry. Right? I spend more of that on rent.
Maybe not if you move to Louisiana, though.
That's not even going to cover rent for me. Even if you move to Louisiana, who's living on $25,000?
No, 100% true.
Yeah.
And then San Francisco, the section is like $110,000 for San Francisco Opera. I have friends who live in San Francisco and say, if you're making less than 200, you're poverty. So what are we doing, guys? So when I hear people having conversations about, you know, you couldn't make it in classical music, I'm like, yeah. So is that my problem or is that just a symptom of the economics? And so I feel like there's a need for a new word, because one thing with branding and marketing is that words have power. And when you occupy a word in the mind of a consumer, you have so much more leverage. And so I was like, let's create a new word. Extra classical. It's classical plus. You can play classical music, but you also understand the nuances of other genres and can find ways to provide value as a string player to other genres. Because just playing the string instrument does not add value to other genres. You have to play it the right way. And if you play it classical, you can make it sound cringy. You make it sound hokey and authentic. And like, you don't really care about anything other than classical music. And I think that's a really bad brand that we've built for ourselves. And I think it's time to move beyond that. And it's not just the playing. I think entrepreneurship is a huge component of it. I think being able to stack unrelated skills on top of your classical chops is critical. So it's about skill stacking. It's about thinking outside the box. It's about creating your own path.
It's so good. Thank you so much for listening today. If you loved this episode, consider writing us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Thanks also to our season sponsor, Potter Violins.
If you'd like to support the podcast and get access to bonus content, consider joining our Patreon community.
You can buy all your musician-centric merch, including shirts, water bottles, koozies, and a variety of other fun items.
Our theme music was written and produced by JP Wogan and is performed by Steph and myself.
Our episodes are produced by Liz O'Hara and edited by Emily McMahon.
Thanks again for listening. Let's talk soon.
Thanks for listening today. This has been part one of our conversation with Drew Ford, so make sure that you stay tuned for part two coming in a couple days.